Okay, hello. So today I'm going to talk about a work which is in collaboration with Tobias Fritz, which you all know him. He was a postdoc. He is now at Max Planck in Leipzig. And this is ongoing, so we don't have the full results, but we have some results. And
Is there a microphone on or
yeah,
is it switched on?
I think so.
Yeah, but maybe
It's on. I have
it's on.
it.
Okay, good.
It's on.
I could.
Can you get louder in the room?
I can shout
Just
more.
marginally.
Louder would be good. Yes.
Big. Okay, so what I'm going to try and explain today is an equivalence between, on one side, sister algebras, and on the other side, Cauchy's with self-action. I'll explain what these guys are. But essentially, what we're trying to do is to show that these two structures are equivalent descriptions of the same thing. So that is what we're trying to do. So now, why are we trying to do this? So the aim eventually is to try and define an axiomatization of quantum theory. The way we're going to do it is precisely by defining an equivalence of categories between the category of sister unit or sister algebras and the category of Cauchy's with self-action. So here, when I say categorical equivalence, I just again mean that these are two mathematical structures which describe the same thing. But it will become clear later. Now I'm just trying to give a kind of general outline of the talk. So that is the strategy, and why that's the strategy also will become clear later on. That's what we're trying to do in order to get an axiomatization of quantum theory. Now, as I said, it's not complete, so we have a partial result. So the partial result that we have is that as long as you just consider measurements, then you get a reconstruction of quantum theory. So we don't have this full equivalence. We have some kind of relaxed version of these two objects, which are kind of equivalent. And what it means is that if you only consider measurements, so no dynamics, then you get a reconstruction of quantum theory. Obviously, the challenge is to introduce also dynamics, and for that, you need the full equivalence. This is roughly the outline of the talk. Now, before telling you how we get to this equivalence, etc., I'll introduce some mathematical objects. Yeah, sorry. Okay, so now I'll introduce the concept of a functor. Now, maybe people already know what it is, but maybe you don't. So I'm not, in the talk, I'm not going to try, at least I'll try as little as I can to give like rigorous definitions and try instead of explaining things through examples, which I think is easier, because if I just gave you the rigorous definition, it might just be gibberish, really. So I'll try and give examples. So I'll explain what a functor is through some examples. Well, one example. Okay, so assume that you have some system S. Assume you have some system S. And you have a set of measurements on that system which takes value in some space X, some other space X. Now, imagine that you have also a set of measurements always of that system S, which now take value in some other space Y. Now, it is possible to define a map between this set of measurements which takes value in X to a set of measurements which takes value in Y through a coarse graining or post-processing. Now, the collection of all this set of measurement outcomes together with this post-processing maps forms a category. So it's basically, a category is essentially a collection of objects with relations between them. In this case, the objects are a set of outcomes and the relations are coarse grainings. So, okay, we have the system S. So now imagine that he has a set of measurement outcomes X, Y, W, Z, and you have post-processing between them or coarse grainings. Now, what a functor is basically an assignment to each of the set of outcomes of another set. I'll say in a second what this thing is. Such that if you have a relation, in this case coarse graining, you also get a relation up here. So this is a functor. In our case, what are these things here? These things here are essentially the set of measurements on your system S, which gives outcome in X. So here you have set of measurements with outcome in X, set of measurements with outcome in Y, et cetera, et cetera. And these maps here basically tell you how post-processing acts on measurements. It takes a measurement of S with outcomes in X, and it transforms it to a measurement always on S with outcomes in Y. And this is the functor. So the technical, notation here. So this is the functor F, which you can call the functor of measurements, right? Because it really assigns to each set of outcomes the measurements which give those set of outcomes.
And my measurements are understood like abstractly, yeah? It's whatever.
I'll tell you in a second what they are. Okay. So not the next slide. This is just to kind of word the description, to make the concept. I'm going to make it rigorous now. It's just to make, give you an idea. So, okay, now, what are the measurements? Okay, so, as I said, now, any system S, you get this functor of measurements. Now, normally, each system, you can describe it in terms of a unit or sister algebra. So I don't know if people are familiar with unit or sister algebras, but it's just a way of describing a quantum system without talking about Hilbert spaces, and such that any operator, unit or any operator, is an element of the sister algebra. So now what we have is that for each system S, you have a sister algebra associated with it. So for each sister algebra, you get a functor, this thing here, of measurements. The thing is that half of the slide is missing. How do you make it? There's lots of other stuff. How do you make it?
That's the cheap way.
Yeah, hang on. So maybe full screen? Yeah.
I think it's.
And I just did this one. Oh, yeah, that's kind of the cheap way. So. No, that's too much. Sorry. Yeah. Kind of has this thing here. All right. Sorry about that. Okay. Okay, so we have this functor of measures. So again, at the level of the base category, we have this Hausdorff spaces with post-processing or continuous maps between them. And up here, we have set of measurements, which are now seen as star homomorphism between the commutative algebra associated to the space X and the sister algebra associated to your system. And at the level of the maps here, again, we have maps which basically tells you how post-processing acts on measurements. So it takes a measurement here, so a measurement on A with value in X, to a measurement on A with values in Y. So now this is the definition. I'll explain it a bit better later, just now. The next slide, but again, this I interpret as measurements on A which takes value in X And the maps are basically transformations of measurements in A with values in X to measurements in A with values in Y, for example. So now, what are the measurements? Okay, so an intuitive way of understanding why those star homomorphisms are measurements is as follows. So in the Schrödinger picture, right, a measurement given a system S is roughly a map from your system, so from the state, so maybe, I don't know, some state space to the probability distributions on the space of outcomes of measures. It's kind of what a measure is considered to be. So I don't know, you get a density matrix and you get a probability distribution on the space of outcomes. Now if you dualize it, so if you kind of go to the Heisenberg picture, this is equivalent to a map from functions on your space of measures, or space of outcomes, to the algebra. So in that sense, this guys here are measures on A with outcome on X. It's basically the Heisenberg picture here. I think it's better if I just do like that. Stop using. Okay, so now, given a set of measurements with values in X, how do you transform it to a set of measurements with outcomes in Y? So how exactly does this map work? So imagine you take a measurement on A with values in X, then you apply this map, and allegedly you should get a measure on X with values in Y. So how exactly do you do that? So we know that we have a post-processing between X and Y. And we know that for each compact house of space, the Gelfand duality gives us a commutative sister algebra of maps on that space. So you get the same for Y. And now we know that if there is a map between these two, which in this case is a post-processing, you get a Gelfand transform, which gives us a map between the two algebras. So basically, what you get is something like this. So you have a measure on A with values in X. You have your Gelfand transform. You compose, and you get a measure on A with values in Y. So the dual picture maybe is, I don't know, is clearer. The dual picture is the other way around. So you get a physical system. You get a measure and you get a certain value outcome, you post-process it, you combine, and you get a measure with values in Y.
Are you calling it post-processing because it's like Markov map but without the requirement of being linear or something like that?
Well, just call it as in a coarse graining type thing. So it is simply you have a set of measurements and you just map them to another set of measurements in a very.
These C of X's, these are just continuous functions with values in C, right?
Yeah.
And this map here, that you're like this Gelfand transform guy on the right, this is just like pull back concretely, right?
Huh.
Like C of F.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Could I ask one more thing?
Yeah, sure.
Just to justify your comments, if X is finite, you said that then the star homomorphisms from C of X into A.
Oops, I forgot even to say that. Yes, you're right. Our projective value measure.
Yeah, so if X is finite, then C of X is just going to be like C to the N?
Yes, precisely.
So.
And then you see, yeah, exactly. And then once you apply the F to the basis of C to the N, then the condition of this F to be a star homomorphism basically implies that the image of F on the basis is a family of projection operators, which are also.
What does complete mean in this context?
Span.
Span.
you just add to Unity. And the orthogonal.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Just in that sense. Motion. Yeah. Sorry, good point. I forgot to mention that. Yeah, so in the finite case, yeah, that is basically PVMs, the projective value measures.
Yeah.
In the infinite case, there should be regular projective value measures, but we're still working on that.
They should be, sorry?
I think they should be regular projective value measures for the infinite case.
They should be projection valued measures on which space? On.
No, if x is finite, infinite, sorry.
I think they should. And you think they should be projection value measures?
Regular projection.
On X? Like the
no, measure, no, on A.
The operator is acting on A, but when you say measure, that implies that there's like a measure on some space, which is taking values in A?
Yeah, right, sorry.
And the measure is on X?
Yeah, sorry.
Cool, yeah.
Yeah, on. But admit, okay, we're still working on the infinite case. Right, so yeah, that projection, that's actually, it was silly that I forgot to say that because that's a good one. Right. Okay, so through the Gelfand transform, we see how up here the maps are defined. Okay, so how do you interpret all this? Or let's give an example of all this. So imagine that you have two very trivial spaces. One is the three-point space, one is the two-point space, and you're giving a post-processing map which essentially identifies these 2 points. It's just a continuous map between topological spaces, right? So I index the points so you can see which 2 points get identified. Now imagine that you're given a family of orthogonal projection indexed by these 3 points, and you want to see how they get mapped through this post-processing to a family of orthogonal projection indexed by these 2 points. Now, a family of orthogonal projection on indexed by these 3 points is just P1, P2, P3. And given this post-processing, it's kind of straightforward to see that its action at the level of projection operators is basically just joining, adding the two P's, P1 and P2, and P3 just stays the same. So this is a very trivial example of how, given a family of projection operators here, which can be seen as a measure which takes value in X, you get a family in here which takes values in Y. Okay, now, so we've seen that for each system represented through a C-star algebra, you get this functor of measures. And this functor of measures is such that to each set of outcomes, it associates the set of measures which gives that outcome in such a way that you have post-processing, and here you can map measures with outcome in X to measure the outcome in Y. So now we want to turn this thing into a cosheaf. So I'm not going to give the definition of a cosheaf, because it's just going to be a bit too involved. But what it actually means, that this thing is a cosheaf, it's the important bit. And what it actually means is that if you have a family of compatible measures, where compatible in this case means that when restricted to a common set of outcomes, they coincide, so to speak, then you can uniquely fine-grain them or join them to a measure which coarse-grains to this individual measures you had with. So compatible set of measures, or compatible set of coarse-grained measures, uniquely combined to a fine-grained measure. That is the sheaf condition. Now, it turns out that the compatibility conditions of on the measures is so strong that it actually requires them to commute. Now, I'll give three examples of this Kursheev condition, so to make it a little bit clearer. The first example actually fails, and the reason it fails, so it doesn't satisfy this condition, is precisely because the compatibility condition is very weak. The other two work. Okay, so that is the example. So you have four spaces. One is the four-point space, and two are the two-point space, and one is the one-point space. So I'll just draw it a second. So you have this. And you have post-processing. So this identifies these 2 points, identifies these 2 points. Well, everything gets identified to the 1 point. And here you identify these 2 points, you identify these 2 points. So this is the base category. And now you're given a set of measures here. So we're in the finite case, so basically it is a set of projection operators indexed by these guys. So we'll call them R1, 2, R3, 4, Q1, 3, Q2, 4. And their requirement, the compatibility condition, is that they coincide when kind of pulled to a section over the one element. So the projection operator here is obviously unity. So the compatibility condition, such that they coincide when pulled down to here, is true. It just says that they decompose unity. So it's utterly trivial. It doesn't tell you anything, really. Still, what we're trying to do is to find a family of projection operators indexed by this 4 points. So we're going to P1, P2, a P3, a P4, which coarse-grain to this guy. And this family has to be unique. OK, so how do you do it? So the requirement that they coarse-grain to these guys is essentially that R12 is equal to P1 plus P2. And Q, for example, right, is equal to 2P1 plus P3, et cetera, et cetera. So we require them to coarse grain. If they existed, we'd require them to coarse grain to the ones you had. So if they existed, then a way of defining them would be this, because it would respect the coarse graining. So now let's have this as candidates. So now we have to check if they're projection operators. So the first thing you check is they're self-adjoint. Now, the condition of self-adjointness, here's for P1, for example, requires that the Qs and Rs commute. Now, the other condition that we have is that the Qs and Rs sum to unity. But again, this is trivial, right? So there will be many families of projection operators indexed by these 2 points and these 2 points, which obviously sum to unity by definition, but which do not commute. So we can't find this piece. Obviously, if we're in the commutative case, then we would be able to find the piece. I mean, this is the pullback, basically. And in that sense, it's unique. But if we're in the non-commutative case, then we can't find it. Now, this is another example that works. Well, this isn't an example that works. This didn't work. OK, without ruining it. So now again, we have the 4-point space, and this time we have 3 points, 3 points, 2 points. Again, we're given a family of projection operators indexed by these 3 points, so R4, R3, R1, 2, and here again, Q1, Q2, Q3, 4, such that they are compatible, meaning that this relation holds. Now, given this post-processing, and given that we want a family of P which coarse-grained through this post-processing, the obvious candidates would be these guys here. P4 goes to Q4, 3, 3, etc. And indeed, they do coarse-grain to the desired projection operators. And we can then check the various properties. I mean, self-adjointed is trivial, and orthogonality also is satisfied. So in this case, we actually do get a family of projection operators indexed by these 4 points, which is uniquely defined as the fine graining of the compatible families of coarse grain measures. So in this, and the reason being that this time the compatibility condition actually tells you something. It wasn't trivial like before. Okay, now we have a third example, which is, it's a bit more complicated, but it has a nice physics interpretation, at least we think so. Okay. So imagine you have two spaces now. You have a space X, any X could be anything, and the unit square. And you consider all maps between these two spaces. Then again, we're given a family of compatible measures which take values in the unit square. So we have this family. Now the compatibility condition on this family of measures, or family of projection operators, implies that these measures have to commute. So basically this. For each of this map, you get a measure, and given any two of these measures, then they commute in this sense. So what it actually means is that the range of all these measures actually maps into a commuting subset of A. So if effectively we can replace this notation by this. So any commuting C-star algebra can be seen as the C-star algebra function on some space W. So effectively the set of measures now can be expressed in terms of these functions here. Now if you dualize this, remember the Heisenberg-Schrödinger thing, a set of measures expressed in this way is equivalent to Gelfand duality, to maps from your algebra to the unit interval. You just dualize it with Gelfand duality. So what we get is basically this. For each post-processing, from your space X to the unit interval, you get a measure on the unit interval. And you want these measures, that are compatible, you want these measures to glue together to give a measure on X. So this is what it means. You want each of these measures, which now takes values in the unit interval, to give a fine-grained measure, which now takes values in X, such that it coarse-grains through this post-processing to your measures you started with. This would be the Kochief condition. So in order to show this, it suffices to show it for this algebra being, well, the true algebra. So in that case, this diagram here becomes this. And what this says is essentially that each point in your topological space is equivalent to an assignment of a value to each function on that topological space. So what it tells you is that the points in a topological space are in one-to-one correspondence with assignments to values of functions on that topological space. So if you had to interpret this from a physics perspective, what it would mean, well, at least how we interpret it, is that physics is done in terms of numerical measurements. So what I mean by this is that imagine you have some measure which takes value in some complicated space X. In order to define it, if the Kochief condition actually holds, then all you need to do is to post-process it to measures on a nice space, the unit square. So essentially measures would take numerical measures. And then once you've done this coarse graining, and if you know this coarse graining, then you can recombine them uniquely to define the original measure which took value in some complicated space. So in this sense, whatever measure you're considering that takes value in whatever complicated space you have, if the Kochief condition holds, then you just really need measures that take value in the essentially complex numbers. This is the interpretation. Now, it would be interesting to know what happens if instead of the unit square, you consider the unit interval. So would it suffice to do physics by taking measures which just are real valued? And this is an open problem, because we do not know if the Kochief condition is satisfied if instead of having post-processing that go to the unit interval, unit square, you go to the unit interval. So that's an open problem. Okay, so trying to recapitulate what has been said. So we've said that for each system, which can be represented through some C-star algebra A, you can define the functor of measures, which assigns to each set of outcomes of measures on A the collection of actual measures that gives that outcome. And we've seen that the base category can be interpreted as post-processing. The top categories are interpreted as the effects of post-processing on measurements. And we've seen that this object satisfies the Kochief condition if for each compatible collection of compatible coarse grain measures, there is a unique way of combining them to a fine grain measure, which coarse grains to the things you started with. So this is what we've obtained so far. But admittedly, these Kochiefs are kind of complicated objects. So now we're trying to see if there's a nicer or easier way to describe this complicated object. And it turns out that there is, and this is given by partial C-star algebras. Now, okay, this time I did put the definition, but so a partial C-star algebra is basically a C-star algebra. What's that? Which such that there is a collection of elements, a set of elements, which commutes between them. And on that set of elements, you can define this binary operations. Clearly, if the set is the entire algebra, you just get a commutative C-star algebra. Which is what I wrote there. Now, it turns out that the collection of this partial C-star algebras form a category. And so the objects are these partial C-star algebras, and the maps are basically partial star homomorphies, so are star homomorphies. And the partial just means that they kind of respect the commutative subsets. it maps commutative subset to commutative subset, and it respects the operations defined on that commutative subset. But anyway, it forms a category. And now we would like to show that the category of partial C-square algebra is equivalent as categories to the categories of functors defined on this category of a set of outcomes, this compact house of spaces. Now, we didn't quite define the full equivalence. That would be nice, but I mean, there's reason to believe that it does hold, but we haven't found it yet. So what we showed is that this guy here is a subcategory, and it is that subcategory for which this holds. So it's the subcategory for which, given any two measurements which take values in the unit square, there exists at most one joint measurement. So that is how you define this subcategory. Okay, what is the interpretation of all this? So the interpretation is the following, that assuming that each physical system is given as a functor on C house, on the category of compact house of spaces, assuming that it is physically meaningful to have this Kochief condition, so it's physically meaningful to assume that compatible coarse grain measure uniquely combined to a fine grain measure. If it is reasonable to assume that any two measurement joined to at most one joint measure, then the equivalence of our partial sister algebras with the Kochiefs on compact Hausdorff space basically allows us to partially reproduce quantum theory. So I say partially because here we've only ever talked about measurements. There's no dynamics, just measurements. So as far as you just want to talk about measurements, then that equivalence of categories allows you to reconstruct quantum theory. Obviously, you do want to have dynamics in it. And in order to have dynamics in it, you need to go to the full, also non-commutative structure. So here we just had partial sister algebras. We really would like to go to the full sister algebras to get all the non-commutative stuff. So how do you do this? You basically equip your partial sister algebra, equivalent to your Kochief, with what is called a self-action. Basically, you have your algebra, and you have a self-action, which is a map from the set of the collection of unitaries in your algebra, to a map of automorphisms on your algebra. And the action is, and obvious how the action is defined. Obviously, if A is commutative, this thing is trivial. Now, the reason we introduced this self-action is, to account for non-commutativity, but also as a way of axiomatizing the fact that in quantum theory, every observable basically generates some dynamics. So because every unitary here, for every unitary, you get an automorphism. So it's an axiomatization of the fact that any observables through exponentiation gives a dynamics. Now it turns out that this partial sister algebras with this self-action form a category. And now what we would like to show is that the category of unit or sister algebras is actually equivalent to this category of partial sister algebras with self-action. We're not there yet. I mean, this is ideally what we would like to show. But as I said, it's work in progress, so we haven't shown it yet. But this is the final result we're trying to achieve. Okay. So now, how is this to be seen as an axiomatization of quantum theory? So we have identified essentially these axioms. And the first is that a physical system should be described in terms of a functor on the space of compact house of, on the category, sorry, of compact house of spaces in the way that I described. It should satisfy the Kochiff condition. So again, compatible coarse grain measure uniquely combined to fine grain measure. It should be such that given two measurements, they can combine to at most one joint measure. And it should come equipped with a self-action. So these are the axiom that we think quantum theory should satisfy. Now I have to admit, so my interest in this comes more from a maths point of view. So more from the fact that is, for me at least, it's interesting that a sister algebra can be seen in terms of co-sheaves with self-action. So it's a different way of defining sister algebras. But the physics, since each sister algebra is described a quantum system, the physical interpretation is that you can axiomatize, what a possible axiomatization of quantum theory is this. Now, I know that there are others, axiomatization of quantum theory, and I'm bit ignorant in the matter. But I think in my limited knowledge, I think that each of them uses state space and stochastic mixtures. So just want to point out that we don't. But that's as far as my knowledge of other approaches goes. So I don't know much about it. But okay, there's still, what are the open problems? So the many. So the first is, does this equivalence really hold? So is it true that partial sister algebras are equivalent to co-sheaves on Hausdorff spaces? We've shown that this is a subcategory, but we haven't proved or disproved the full equivalence. Hopefully we prove it. We don't know yet. The other problem is what happens if we replace the unit square with the unit interval. So remember that the fact that this kind of maps satisfied all this post-processing, satisfied the Kochiff condition, meant that any measure which gets a value in some complicated space X can be derived as long as you know the post-processings and the compatible measures which take value in the complex numbers. So now the question is, again, what happens to this? So what if you just have real valued measures? We don't know that yet. And finally, well, this is the crux of the matter. Is it true that this category is actually equivalent? So is it true that a sister algebra can be seen as essentially a co-sheaf with self-action? If that is the case, then the axiomatization of quantum theory would make sense. Otherwise, not really. But we hope that that is the case. Okay. That's it. Is it clear at all? Yeah.
Why do you use the closed intervals? Like, it seems like if you want R and C, like the result for C is definitely true, what you say about being able to understand this guy in terms of, but you use like a closed guy, which isn't really the same as C.
A closed guy.
Like if there were no edges on the box, then it would be like the same as C. Kind of know what I'm saying? Like you use the closed interval as opposed to the open interval. Like
if you want to have
square brackets instead of open brackets.
Oh, but here you mean?
Yeah. Or in the square you have that square.
Well, square just in the sense of, yeah.
Yeah.
You have two numbers, hence the complex number.
But why would you have edges on that? Because it's not really the same as C. Understand? Like the concrete mathematical statement, if it helps, is like, R2 is not homeomorphic to a closed square,
mm-hmm.
but it's homeomorphic to an open square.
Mm-hmm.
And like, the maps to C is definitely the natural thing to consider. I agree with you there.
Yeah.
But I don't know why
sorry,
I keep drawing this closed.
Be like that.
Yeah. That's
I see.
Yeah.
Oh. All right. Yeah. That's.
Gonna make more sense.
Yeah. Probably you're right. Actually. Okay. Yeah. Because I was thinking this is defined in terms of kind of two coordinates and C. But yeah, okay, you're right. Topologically, it's probably that.
Yeah. So you're probably aware of this, but this is sort of just like this construction of sending A to this functor. This
mm-hmm.
thing you're calling a Cauchy poem. Maybe I should ask, is there a reason you say Cauchy and not functor? Like, is there some geometric picture you have?
Well, a Cauchy is not
the functor. Oh, the pre-thing. Yeah. Sure.
So a functor is a pre-sheaf.
Yeah.
Oh, I just don't want to use that word because it sounds daunting.
Yeah. No, fair enough. No, I think functor is better. But anyways, I was going to say, this construction you're doing is something like just doing the Yoneda embedding. You know what I mean by this?
Yes.
And then just there's an inclusion of like C Haas into C star algebra op. And then you're just pulling back, like you do the Yoneda embedding and then just pulling it back by this.
Okay.
So if you think about it this way, there might be some like formal, I'm not like a pro at category theory, but I know Tobias is. And there might just be some like formal properties of subcategories that tell you that you're getting something like close to all of the information when you restrict Yoneda to some subcategory. There's some like formal.
I
don't know the exact
trying
condition,
to
but I know that
out.
Some things like this exist and are like commonly known.
I think it amounts to a question about whether we can impose some specific Grothendieck topology there.
It's not that it doesn't give a Grothendieck topology. That's the thing. It's really weird. It is almost a Grothendieck topology that you get,
mm-hmm.
but it's not closed on the pullbacks, so I don't actually know what you get. So like something like pre-topos, I don't know.
What happens when you enforce this condition? And can you relax something else to enforce? Like, because Grothendieck topology is something like pretty canonical, yes? Because it gives you a sheafification functor, and you can like get more things more geometrically, like the question is like, you know, if the structure doesn't give it, maybe there is a possibility of somehow relaxing something about structure itself. In order to actually be able to
get a Grothendieck.
Yes. I mean, you know, somehow there was always like a trade-off, yeah, between like the structure and like the maps that you can get based on the structure.
Yeah,
and somehow.
Because the thing is, okay, so for example, okay, this is a bit technical.
I wanted to provoke you for.
So what happens is that you get a covering sieves, and this covering sieves have to be defined this way. So what it tells you is that basically that given any two arrows in this covering sieve, so any in this sense any measurement, then you can always find a fine graining which kind of restricts to your original ones. So essentially what this tells is that your sieve has enough joint measurements such that these measurements commute.
This is not, there is nothing like equalizer here or something, no?
No, no, just because in order to get the Kochiff condition, right? So the Kochiff condition tells you that, so if you have a bunch of these guys, coarse-grained, they have to somehow combine to a fine-grained measure. So if they have to combine to a fine-grained measure, then, I mean, they have to commute. It's necessary, right? Because there's loads of them, and they all have to give one single thing from C of X. So it has to commute. These guys have to, the image has to commute.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing is given by this properties of the coverings. I mean, it maybe is not easy to see, but it tells you that it has enough arrows, it has enough joint measurements such that it guarantees that all the individual ones actually commute.
But this is the sufficient necessary? Or?
This is necessary, the sufficient necessary. This is the necessary. But then, so that is why we have to use these coverings. I mean, it could be that there is something better, right? But it has to be some set of coverings with somehow guarantees commutativity.
Yeah.
And in terms of this, we don't get a grotendieck topology.
Because if it's not necessary, that might be the issue, yeah? That there might be some like refined form or.
So that's, yes.
But I have no, it's like. The argument is structural, it's not that I can, you know, tell you
yeah,
like,
no,
something
no, no.
specific.
But do you actually know what, if you have a topology which is not Grothendieck because it doesn't preserve, it's not, it doesn't preserve pullbacks,
mm-hmm.
what do you get? Pre-topos? Do you know?
The old examples that I studied were always like Grothendieck topologies or even subtopologies, so.
Huh. So, I mean, it would be good if somehow you can guarantee commutativity in this sense by using a different topology that gives you Grothendieck, that would be good. But we can't think of it.
Maybe this is the reason to look like some original papers from 70s. Like there are some examples, I don't know.
Probably.
So, something that I wanted to maybe humbly suggest or something,
mm-hmm.
if you're looking at trying to get some category that's equivalent to these Kochiffs, which maybe isn't the guy that you talked about before,
uh-huh.
but so if you look at, like, just to motivate what I'm going to say, if you look at like one of these embeddings here, right, of these like these C of Y dudes, that's the image is going to be some commutative subalgebra, right, and you could look for say like a maximal commutative subalgebra containing that guy,
mm-hmm.
And there's not going to be like a unique one or anything,
yeah.
but then your sort of condition on all of the other guys is that they all their images are contained in this maximal commutative subalgebra for any given one,
mm-hmm.
right? And there's nothing special about just picking one; they all have to be contained in the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you wanted to know like what controls this Yoneda, essentially, like I phrased it as like C Haas should be equivalent to just commutative unit all C star algebras, right? So it's really just like restricting your Yoneda to commutative,
yeah.
to the commutative guys inside
mm-hmm.
there, right?
Right.
So if you wanted to know like what controls the restriction of this sort of like functor of points for these to the commutative dudes, something like some kind of family of maximal commutative subalgebras.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you could somehow, I don't know if this is something that in practice, I'm not really like a functional analyst, which
mm-hmm.
maybe you like know better.
But what do you mean about like controlling?
Well, like what object would know all of the information of what all, like given some commutative C star algebra, what all the maps into a given C star algebra are?
Oh, gotcha.
And like what the relationships between the different given morphisms of commutative.
Not necessarily commutative.
The big guy is not necessarily commutative, right? But our small guys are all commutative, and we all the maps between them, like the category C Haas here, we may as well just be calling it commutative C star algebra.
There might be some statement about annihilators, because these are C star algebra, so it's like you cannot do things by projectors, but maybe there are some like characterizing statements based on annihilators. But it's like, you know, like the sort of structure theory of sister algebras is pretty, because like you actually...
Yeah, I actually don't know that much about it.
Yeah, but you actually ask that it's like a question that fits already to the sort of structural theory of sister algebras and like the it's like the classification issue. It's like, it's kind of problematic. Like, for some reason, works on like using annihilators. But I don't know how to, you know, I'm lacking the super exact knowledge to address this.
But do you sort of see what I mean? Like somehow all you need to really know about A, like what is all the information you need to know about A to determine its functor of points restricted to the commutative C-star algebras? Because all of their images...
All I need to know about A, so we
like
for
so
any A, yeah?
It's clear that the category C-star algebra is bigger than these co-sheaves on C-haws. You like don't think that those are going to be equivalent. You think that you need this self-action.
Same, yes.
Yeah, you need some extra data.
Yeah.
So the question is, like, what could you... You have some C-star algebra. What could you throw away such that you could still determine, like, what information could you extract from it such that you could still determine the functor of points? So the functor of points usually, when I say functor of points, I mean the image under Yoneda, usually totally determines A. But now if you just want to know the image under Yoneda but restricted to the commutative guide, like what information about A, just like in the thinking in the concrete category, like not being so sort of fancy or anything, just like what information about A do you need to determine all of these morphisms just from the commutative guys? And somehow, since all their images are going to be commutative subalgebras, you only really need to know about this sort of like how all the different commutative subalgebras in A all fit together or something like this.
And actually, how to translate from one stage to other stage.
Yeah, to the different, like there are different ones. And, it's a pretty vague idea, and I'm not like an expert in this area at all, but that's something like this
good.
Is like roughly the information you need to know about A. And so you could probably like construct some category that looked like
maybe some subcategory
of,
which gives
like
you
collections
exactly
of commutative algebras which somehow fit together in some kind of way, something like that. And that's like the right thing.
To then go, that's interesting, that's a good idea.
I had a question about axioms 2 and 3, like on that slide. Yeah, so the co-sheaf condition you said is about the fact that there's this unique fine grading for a given set of observables in some sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so one question is, if you were to try to relax this requirement of uniqueness, presumably you would not get co-sheaves. And how easy would it be to formalize a sort of, like, I mean, would your program completely change if I said that, okay, I could give you two different fine gradings for the same set of observables? Also, like, okay, yeah, this is the first question. The second question is, I was having trouble seeing how the axiom 3 does not follow from 1, because it seems like...
So here, it kind of does follow, but here I'm just saying that given any two measurements, there is at most 1. It could be 0, but it's at most 1.
Okay.
Here, the co-sheaf condition tells you, given that they are compatible, there is...
So the intuition seems to be that, in quantum theory, it's true that if you have like a bunch of projective measurements, then the fact that like they only admit a unique sort of joint measurement if they all commute, right? Like the, they all have to commute, and the joint measurement is unique.
Yes.
But
right.
this is usually not true if you're looking at like POVMs, like positive operator value measures, and not PVMs. Because once you relax the projective property, you can construct different fine gradings for the same set of observables.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering if you know, quantum theory with POBMs is a part of this axiomatization, or is it just pure, you know, quantum theory with only projective measurements and?
So far, yes.
Okay.
So yeah, do answer the question.
Because
in
that mean fine grain thing is very specific to projective.
Yeah, then in that case you would have to relax the Kirchhoff condition,
yeah.
And then you wouldn't get a Kirchhoff history. You would get a
Kirchhoff. Yeah, so I'm assuming that this axiomatization
Kirchhoff.
Is for sort of, in some sense, pure quantum theory.
Yeah.
But you have kind of stated this at the beginning, yeah, that in finite dimensional
yeah,
case
we did
you
everything
use
in finite dimensional
like the composition of unity, which
yeah.
is basically PDF, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, we did everything in the finite dimensions, and we have assumed that these measures are really family of projection operators.
I just want a super short comment to this, what Dylan was saying. Like, maybe just lattice structure would be sufficient, actually. I'm not
of
sure.
The collection of
yes.
abelians commutative subalgebras.
Yeah, because after all, you deal with sieves and cosieves, yeah? So, like, this, you know, this internal structure. I mean, if you can look, this is like, this is connected with the other thing, which is called cohating algebras.
Cohating.
Yeah. And like, so it's like, because, well, anyways.
When
so.
You say lattice, you just mean like there's some directed graph of them
yeah.
with arrows
yeah, yeah.
for inclusion.
But basically, like, this is a sort of suggestion. I will think about this more and comment. Like, maybe that. But I think that this is kind of sort of intuition that lattice structure might be enough. Like, if you like remember the old stuff with logic and topos and so on,
mm-hmm.
like, in a way, this lattice structure there was determining
yeah,
a lot of
this,
a lot of
yes,
like internal behavior
true.
And also how what was happening when you pass from one stage to other stage.
Yeah.
Like this lattice, more precisely hating algebra structure was sufficient. Here it's like not really hating algebra.
Yeah, no.
But again, like lattice structure should be not just like you know, conjecture, yeah, but I think about this more.
I have one more question. Just isn't there like a second Kirchhoff condition?
A second.
Like, aren't there usually two? I mean, I usually think about sheaves more than Kirchhoffs in my life, but there's
that's
usually
actually.
Like this. There's this gluing axiom, and then there's this vanishing axiom for sheaves, right?
Gluing axiom and vanishing.
So there's one that says if you have to think concretely in terms of like functions or something, right? Like our favorite sheaf. It says like if you have functions on a bunch of open sets and they agree on the intersections,
mm-hmm.
then you can glue them together.
Yeah.
And then there's another thing which says if you have a function and it restricts to all the open sets to be zero, then it's got to be the zero function.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And so presumably in the Kirchhoff thing, you just flip all the arrows or whatever. But you throw away. I wish I could show you. I don't actually think about Kirchhoffs in my.
No, you still have equalizers in this case. Also in our Kirchhoffs, it's just that instead of having sieves, you have cosieves.
I don't know exactly what that means. Sorry. I guess so far you did only discuss like the one of those two axioms in the Kirchhoff case, though, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, you get also the other one.
But is the other one is just fine or something?
You get exactly the same axiom, so it still goes to zero. It's just that the basis is now flipped. In that sense, you get cosieves.
Okay, sure. But
so you
I
still
guess...
get equalizers. So you know the sheaf condition is this, right? So given a covering or a sieve of X, and a sieve is basically a collection, in this case it's a covering, right? So it's a collection of maps from something into X. Then the equalizer just tells you that this. Is what you said, really. if you have a bunch of sections, which are, so this is an equalizer saying that if I've got a bunch of sections which are compatible, then you get a unique one. We have exactly the same definition.
That's the exactness at the middle spot.
Sit.
What you just said. Exactness at the middle position tells you that if you have a bunch of guys agreeing, i.e. in the kernel of this difference,
mm-hmm.
then it comes from
yeah.
the image of the previous right. dude.
So we have exactly the same, it's just now you have co-sheaves.
I'm totally with you, but then there's totally another thing that says it's like basically exactness at the left position. Like if you put zero into f of x, there should be exactness at this position.
Oh.
And then there should be, like, this is also part of the sheaf axioms, right? That you have exactness throughout here.
Oh, okay.
And so there should be some corresponding co-sheaf condition.
Exactly the same. It's just that, maybe the term co-sheaf is slightly different because you still get equalizers, you don't get co-equalizers. The only thing that you is the covering. You get co-covering.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So it's probably, in a lot of the literature is listed, is considered so that you switch everything so you get to co-equalize, etc. We don't do that. We just consider co-covering.
Okay.
Yeah, this was
kind
of...
The other way around.
But I guess what I'm just getting at is that throughout when you talked about the co-sheaf condition, it seemed like you were just talking about exactness in the middle place. But then, like, what does exactness here mean in terms of quantum theory or something like that? You know what I mean?
I was saying it in a very descriptive way in terms of gluing measures. So, yes, okay. I was a bit sloppy in that sense. So I never really said what the co-sheaf condition is. I just said what it means
uh-huh,
is this union.
Uh-huh. But it seemed like when you were translating, you were only ever translating the middle guy or something.
Yeah,
there should be some additional
much.
Thing like if you have some measure such that all of its post-processings are trivial or stupid,
okay, yeah, so
then
should,
it must
yeah,
be a
okay.
stupid measure. Or something, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
there
okay.
should be some.
Yeah, that.
You mean like drawing conclusion from the exactness, yeah?
Yeah, essentially the translation of the co-sheaf condition that she was giving throughout was really just translation
yes,
of
yeah, okay.
exactness at the middle
yeah.
position, but there's also some translations of exactness at the left condition, which is like...
You know, there is a kind of ironic aspect that, like, when you look at topos from the perspective of categories, you somehow are not really interested in the exactness part. It's like more you are interested like in the equalizer part than
yeah.
in the exactness. I think it's sort of the usual mathematical version of application.
So in fact, in the Topos books, you'd never really get that.
Yeah, precisely.
You just
precisely.
Get
okay.
the equalizer.
And this is like more algebraic, geometric
but
perspective.
Still, what you say it is true. Just kind of gloss over that.